Committee on Human Achievement and School Accountability, Tuesday, April 24, 2001, 8:30 a.m. Committee Room E, Ms. Jocelyn Chair.
Committee on Student Achievement and School Accountability. Good morning, colleagues, and welcome to those of you in the audience. We think, anyway, at this point that we will follow the order of the itinerary. And so with that, we will open a public hearing on HCR 8. And John Mosley, I think you are scheduled to testify. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm John Mosley. I'm the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost, University of Oregon. I'm here to testify in favor of House Concurrent Resolution 8, which is a resolution in memoriam of Paul Olem, former president of the University of Oregon, who passed away earlier this year. I want to express appreciation to the committee and House for considering this, and to the representatives who have sponsored this. President Olem is indeed one of the giants in the history of the University of Oregon. I was privileged to enter the University of Oregon as a physics professor while he was provost, and ultimately to serve as his vice president for research.
Sure.
And among the faculty and supporters of the University of Oregon, President Olem is held in tremendous respect as a man of integrity, as a leader, as a person who helped to bring the University of Oregon through one of the most difficult times in its history. I'm sure that all of you remember the early 80s, which occurred right after I moved to the state, and the very difficult recession that the state as a whole went through, the effects that that had on higher education. President Olem began his presidency right at the front end of that and had that to deal with in the early days. The fact that the University of Oregon emerged from those days not only intact, but a tremendously strong university, member of the Association of American Universities and one of the top research universities in the country, is a tribute to his leadership. In fact, over that period of time, while state funding was decreasing for higher education in general, research funding, largely federal funding for the University of Oregon, more than tripled over the period of his presidency. I've pointed out a minor error in the concurrent resolution itself, which is that President Olem was instrumental in building not only Willamette Hall and Deschutes Hall, but also Cascade Hall and Streisinger Hall. In fact, was responsible for, with the help of the legislature and the federal government, for essentially completely rebuilding the science complex at the University of Oregon, and this played a major role in the growth in research grants and contracts and in the university's stature over that period of time. So on behalf of the University of Oregon, I just want to assure you that the university is not only very strongly supportive of this resolution, but also appreciative of the fact that you're considering it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, Dr. Mosley indicated it was line 15, I think, on the HCR 8 that you're referencing.
That's correct, and I've given Representative Barnhart
right.
The spelling.
And it's our intention to correct this with an amendment, and we'll bring this back on Thursday in the work session.
Okay.
Any questions or comments?
Mr.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, I just want to say that I'm glad you're doing this. Certainly deserved.
Thank you. Well, very good. Thank you very much for your testimony. With that, then we'll close the public hearing on HCRA, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2286. Janet, you read it for summary, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2286, and you should have dash three amendments distributed yesterday. The original bill had appropriations both for ESL and bilingual education programs, a $4 million appropriation, and a $1 million appropriation for tuition reimbursement programs for teachers that go into bilingual or ESL teaching programs. The Dash-3 amendments do establish a teacher tuition grant program through the Department of Education and contain a $1 million appropriation for that program. The amendments do delete the rest of the $4 million appropriation that was for other ESL program grants. There is a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee on the measure, and should have the best through.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, we brought the Dash-3 amendments because we had heard testimony, and I think not only in this committee but in other cases, that there was a great need for teacher training and or retraining of ESL teachers. This in particular came from Salinas, who is the superintendent in what I think used to be called the Estacada School District, but now it has a different name. I didn't write that down, but the original bill, as you know, was perhaps a $5 million cost for the Oregon Trail School District. I had a $5 million cost, and we thought probably that's a bit of a stretch given this budget climate. And so we thought perhaps a $1 million price tag on this bill, which would be designed to train or retrain ESL teachers. I thought this might be something that we'd like to consider. And so the Dash-3s are the result. So does anyone have any observations here, any comments?
Representative Smith. I'm probably going to be inclined to vote no on this because there's been some discussion in this building about English immersion. Whether that'll become a reality discussion, I don't know. But if we were to pass this bill and then next session try to implement an English immersion program, as the states of California, who are highly Hispanic, have done, it seems to be very successful. And the state of Arizona is now considering in its beginning stages. That is why I think I'm a no vote on this, Mr. Chair. Because to me, they're in conflict with each other. To pass one and then do another doesn't make sense. Not that I am wholly supportive of teachers in acquiring their extra education. I don't want teachers to think this is a vote against them because it is not. I just think if we're going to be successful in educating people who come from a different language, we all need to be speaking the same words. That's what it boils down to. And I think that's a very, to me, the most sensible thing that has come out of all this. So that's where I'm at on it.
Thank you. Representative Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll vote yes for exactly the opposite reason. Because I guess I don't support the English immersion. I've had visitors in my office who have had a lot of experience with trying to make a transition into English, and it's hard enough to understand the subject matter if you don't understand the language. So I support this bill. I think this would help solve that problem, and so I will go yes. Mr. Chair, do we need to move? Did we move the two?
I think three. We're moving to three. Yeah.
Okay, well,
we haven't moved anything yet.
Okay.
Three is what we're. Is what we're
I would move the Dash-3.
Okay. Representative Morissette moves the Dash-3 amendments to House Bill 2286. Representative Nelson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think consistently throughout this session, we've heard of the shortage of teachers in this area.
Mm.
And so I'm certainly supportive of this program. I'm sorry we couldn't give them the whole $5 million, and I think we've been very reasonable and effectively excellent in at least getting them $1 million. So I'm with you.
Representative Nelson, that's one of the nicest compliments we've had. To be called reasonable is quite a compliment, I must say. Representative Hopkins, you have a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These aren't totally limited to the bad trees, but if you want, I'll go ahead and speak to that. And I would speak to it with a cross and agreeing with both of my colleagues on the right. I believe in immersion programs. I've seen them work well. I believe in bilingual ESL programs. I've seen them work well. And I think the whole point here is that individual schools, individual teachers have to do what works best for their particular situation. I'm going to be opposed to this bill for what probably is a little different reason, and one that you'll hear me say over and over again, I think, before we're out of here. I am so supportive of the $5.2 billion for education and the careful way that that has been crafted with all the parties involved getting the issues that they feel are very, very important included within that $5.2 billion, that I'm not willing to carve out a piece of anything, and I realize the money comes from someplace else, but to address a specific problem, because I could argue just as strongly for a number of other programs and types of kids. The other piece in this, at this point, there is additional money coming in Title I-C that can be distributed in some manner, and districts themselves can look at how to go ahead with this training, because I certainly agree with my colleague here to the left that there is a dire need, but it's not just for these kinds of teachers. There's a need for technology, math, science, all those kinds of things. So again, it's a case of we're splitting off one little piece and we're making a decision on that, and I don't think that's the way it should be run. So I will be voting against it for all of the above and below.
Representative Barnhart.
I'm going to support the Dash 3 as it reduces the cost of the bill.
Representative Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm delighted that we're having this discussion. I think it's very important for us among the committee to have a discussion about different aspects of how to provide support for our K-12 schools. And I think it's fine that we have disagreements. There are reasons that there are several of us on this committee, and it's because we have different perspectives. We represent different parts of the state. We represent different types of districts, and those perspectives need to come out. Having said all that, I support the DAS-3s and I support the bill on the premise that this is in addition to and not in lieu of other funding. I absolutely concur with my good friend from Tillamook that 5.2 is the minimum that this state can responsibly provide to our local school district to achieve what we are asking them to achieve for our K-12 students. It's consistent with the quality education model. It gets us started on the right track for implementing that, and it's our responsibility to do that. We have, throughout the session, heard bills that propose augmentations of that, both financially and programmatically, and I believe this bill does just that. It's very supportive of our strong emphasis on early reading because it provides opportunity for kids who really need the extra support at that critical time when they're learning how to read and decipher, how you put words that you hear verbally into funny little symbols on a piece of paper. So I'm supportive of the DAS-3s, and I'm very appreciative that the bill has come to us so that we can consider it.
I guess I'll weigh in very briefly. It's kind of interesting when you consider this or any other bill that we consider where we are now and where we might conceivably go in the future, as has been pointed out. And so I guess the reality for me is this program, by ESL reading programs and ESL in general, have been with us for a time, and I see them continuing, I guess, and I do see the need for teacher training and or retraining. I think I'm definitely going to be supportive of this amendment and this bill. We have a motion to adopt the DAS-3s. Any further discussion? Any objection? DAS-3s are moved into House Bill 2286. I would entertain a motion to remove 2286 with the amendment. Representative Morris recommendation is made. Very good. Representative Morissette moves House Bill 2286 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Paula, would you call the roll, please? And what's the total here? Okay. Having received the constitutional majority, House Bill 2598 has amended moves to the Ways and Means Committee. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2286. We've had a change in the order. We've had a request to delay House Bill 2598. And so because of that, we will honor that request. We will move into a work session on House Bill 3378. Janet, when you can gather your folders, we'll proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3378 is the bill that was held over from last week that deals with intellectual property and consultation ability by community college instructors. You have at your, that was distributed yesterday, the Dash 2 amendments. They changed the authority in the measure from having the State Board of Education develop the rules and conflict of interest notification kinds of procedures for this measure to the Board of Education of each community college district. The amendments also specify that the policies and rules be in accordance with collective bargaining agreements, and they delete a provision on the second page of the bill at the very end, the last two lines, that rules have to be consistent with practices of the Board of Education. The Board of Higher Education. And those were the amendments that were discussed at the last meeting, and we needed to get them drawn up and combined. And there is no fiscal impact on the mission.
Well, we're considering a Dash 2.
Yes.
And we have not moved any amendment to this point. That's the chair who moved the Dash 2. Representative Morissette moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3278. Discussion? Any objection? So moved. Representative Morissette, do you have another motion?
Well, I would move House Bill 3278 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Morissette moves House Bill 3278 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Paula, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Nelson? Aye.
Nolan?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Starr?
Excuse? Donner?
Aye.
Hornhart?
Aye.
Hobson?
Aye.
Morissette?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Having received the constitutional majority, House Bill 3278 moves to the floor. And Representative Starr is the sponsor of this bill. Perhaps we should assign him to be the carrier.
I bet he'd appreciate that.
Very good. I would appreciate that.
Carrier for the last bill.
It went away from me. Yeah, so we didn't have a carrier. Okay. With that, then, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3278. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2015. Janet, are you ready for our summary?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Also 2015. The original bill was the 177-page version. It would have abolished the State Board of Higher Education and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission and transferred the powers and duties of those two boards, as well as the State Board of Education related to community colleges, to a new College Opportunity Board, and made conforming changes to those to the statutes. You have distributed yesterday the House Bill 2015-1 amendments, and you should have a revised staff measure summary. It's right, but a revised one. There was I got all the stuff on the background and needed to revise the staff measure summary. The amendments replace the original bill and create a post-secondary education opportunities commission to assist the governor in developing a comprehensive post-secondary budget and to make recommendations regarding institutional autonomy and the governance among the state institutions of higher education and among community colleges. There is also created an Office of Post-Secondary Education Policy in the Office of the Governor to help develop options for the budget and to establish guidelines for distributing funds among the institutions. There are additional elements of the bill that Harvey Matthews may want to speak to and details. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Harvey, it looks like you're pouring over your notes. Perhaps you should get the public. Yes.
Mr. Chair, who brought the amendment for?
The Speaker's Office.
Thank you.
Brought those for.
Good morning, Senator Backlund. My name is Harvey Matthews. I work with Peter Mark Simmons as his legislative director. These amendments were developed by a work group made up of Cam Push Brawley, Joe Cox, Gary Ann Dean, Jeff Sweetser from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, various board members of the Higher Education Board, and Duncan Wise. So they've been a process. The first bill, as you may have seen, is pretty thick and kind of scared people with its all-encompassing nature, and we cut it back quite a bit, as you'll see by the proposed amendment in front of you. This bill attempts to deal with a current problem in higher education. Currently, we have three budgets for higher education dealing with the university system, community colleges, and student assistance. And from the speaker's vantage point, there's a lack of a cohesive statewide strategy for post-secondary education. Our current method of disbursement of funds is divide them out as you guys hear the needs, and that creates winners and losers. I think last session is still pretty fresh in our mind, and we lost the university system, and community colleges got a bit, and student assistance was sort of an afterthought. And because each session brings forth new ideas, whoever's ideas are most compelling, of course, gets the money. And what this attempts to do is solve that problem. We want to have more opportunity for students to access higher education. This is directing the governor to establish a budget that looks at the continuum of post-secondary education and develop a budget that will create more opportunity for students. So 2015, I think, is a solution to the problem of a divided budget that creates a non-comprehensive post-educational strategy. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this point.
Okay, thank you, Harvey.
Question.
Representative Smith, and then Representative Nelson.
So when we're going to fund these interests, who then decides how much money goes to community colleges, the scholarship program, et cetera? How is that determination made?
Chair Backlund, Representative Smith. Currently, the governor proposes a budget. He proposes three different budgets for these three organizations, and this would only direct the governor to create one budget you would still have the oversight for the disbursement of funds.
So our Ways and Means Committee would consider requests from community colleges, for instance, say of a $45 million enrollment package they'd like. They'd still be able to request that within this budget.
Okay.
So the Ways and Means there would be giving out money, so to speak.
Okay. Chair Backlund, Representative Smith. The current Ways and Means oversight would still be addressed. The community colleges would have the opportunity to work with the university system and student assistance in comprehensively putting their budget together. They, in effect, have two opportunities to request, in this example, tuition funding.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Matthews, since I don't know who the people were, you mentioned, maybe somebody else did, but who were the representatives in this committee by category?
Well, they're Sherry Backlund, Representative Nelson, Camper Sprawley from Community College Commission, Workforce, Cam, if you're here, I'm sorry. Joe Cox from the university system, Mary Ann Dean from Independent Colleges, Jeff Sweetser from Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and Duncan Weiss from the Oregon Business Council. And there were some board members, Tom Heineson, I believe, from the Higher Education Board. Sure.
Thank you.
I'm forgetting some people.
That's well. Okay. I just was not familiar with those names. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And who brought this request?
Chair Backlund, Representative Nelson, the Dash 1 Amendment, to clarify that request, or?
We just got here.
Okay. This was from the Speaker's office originally.
And follow up, Mr. Chair, any request for the bill? Where the action came from?
I believe it was originally, Chair Backlund, President Nelson. Originally, I think it came from frustration from last session, dealing with three different budgets and not, and especially with the Student Assistance Commission budget coming in last and not having as much money to put towards, you know, enabling these students that need assistance so badly to give them a leg up. Most of the money for post-secondary education was granted to university system and community colleges. So there's frustration from that. The Oregon Business Council did write up an interesting playbook, which you may have gotten at the beginning of the session, which details a similar idea. And so the marriage of those two, one frustration, one idea, is kind of amalgamated into House Bill 2015.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So, if I understand this correctly, this would have been Mr. Switzer on behalf of the student assistants and Mr. Weiss on behalf of the Oregon Business Council who brought this measure forward.
Representative Backlund.
To the speaker.
Representative Backlund and Mr. Nelson, it was not Mr. Switzer, and it was partly the document of Duncan Wise's Business Council. It was mostly the speaker's personal experience.
Oh, I see. Okay. Thank you. And could you tell me the absolute primary purpose of this bill?
Yes. Chair Backlund, Representative Nelson, the goal of the bill is to create a comprehensive statewide budget so that you, the legislature, can strategically design how you want post-secondary education to be developed in Oregon. You can get your arms around it and not just budget for three separate items, but to feel like you are accomplishing a greater goal of developing a strategy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Morissette.
Thank you. Sure.
I'd like to address the questions that asked. Last session, there was a lot of frustration. I wrote a letter to the governor urging that he do exactly that. Do a continuum of something. Look at all three before making a decision. I did serve in the interim student financial aid committee that the governor appointed. The first thing I asked the governor was, are you going to give any more money for the financial aid? And he said, no. We struggled with the financial aid piece. Nothing really happened. There were a lot of good ideas put out. But I also thought it was a great idea to develop a quality education model for higher ed and another one for the community colleges. And I have two bills which I will speak to that do exactly that. So I think we're all moving in the same direction, and we're addressing a need that does exist, coordinate, and make sense out of the way that we fund higher ed, and we need to have some advocates for that. So I will be really interested in hearing the other testimony to see if this is the right mechanism.
It came from frustration from last session, dealing with three different budgets and especially with the Student Assistance Commission budget coming in last and not having as much money to put towards, you know, entering these students that need assistance so badly to give them a leg up. Most of the money for post-secondary education was granted to the university system and community colleges. So, such frustration from that, the Oregon Business Council did write up an interesting playbook, which you may have gotten at the beginning of the session, which details a similar idea. And so the marriage of those two, one frustration, one idea, and kind of amalgamated into House Bill 2015.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So, if I understand this correctly, this would have been Mr. Switzer on behalf of the student assistants and Mr. Weiss on behalf of the Oregon Business Council who brought this measure forward.
Representative Backlund.
To the speaker.
Representative Backlund and someone else that it was not Mr. Switzer, and it was partly the document of Duncan Wise Oregon Business Council. It was mostly the speaker's personal experience.
Oh, I see. Okay. Thank you. And could you tell me the absolute primary purpose of this bill?
Yes. Chair Backlund, Representative Nelson. The goal of the bill is to create a comprehensive statewide budget so that you, the legislature, can strategically design how you want post-secondary education to be developed in Oregon. You can get your arms around it and not just budget for three separate items, but feel like you are accomplishing a greater goal of developing a strategy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'd like to address the questions that came asked. Last session, there was a lot of frustration, and I wrote a letter to the governor urging that he do exactly that, do a continuum of funding, look at all three before making a decision. I did serve in the interim Student Financial Aid Committee that the governor The first thing I asked the governor was, are you going to give any more money for the financial aid? And he said, no. We struggled with the financial aid piece. Nothing really happened. There were a lot of good ideas put out. But I also thought it was a great idea to develop a quality education model for higher ed and another one for the community colleges. And I have two bills which I will speak to that do exactly that. So I think we're all moving in the same direction. and we're addressing a need that does exist to coordinate and make sense out of the way that we fund higher ed, and we need to have some advocates for that. So I will be really interested in hearing the other testimony to see if this is the right mechanism to do that. It may be, and we'll hear the testimony, but there was a lot of frustration. This has been an effort that has been made by several groups, and I think we're moving in the right direction.
Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you.
Brett and Karen?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Brad and Karen, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System. We are representing Chancellor Joe Cox this morning, who apologizes to you for not being present. He is in on his way to Washington, D.C. He has a conference with Secretary Page and the Department of Education and a visit with him about our PATH program, which has been so successful, assessment, accountability measures, and the other elements of the Oregon University systems reengineering. He apologizes for not being here, but the timing of the of that visit and the posting of this bill, unable to be here. Mr. Matthews is correct. The chancellor was involved in each of the work group meetings which had been held regarding House Bill 2015 and has, I think, politely and very directly stated that the Oregon University system is not seeking a combination of budgets into a uniform bill and opening the issue of governance and restructuring into some kind of a super board. And he's made that fairly clear, and I want to state for the record today that that is the position of the Oregon University system. We understand the frustration that centers around post-secondary education, public post-secondary education in Oregon. We share that frustration, but fail to see why taking three relatively underfunded public post-secondary education entities, combining them into a single underfunded budget, and then having a system of perpetual disequilibrium among the elements over the division of that underfunded budget will lead to an improvement in service to Oregon. Especially fail to understand that when, in fact, to accomplish that goal, you need to create two levels of bureaucracy in the post-secondary education administration, creating first in the 2015-1 amendments the Office of Public Post-Secondary Education Policy in the Governor's Office, with an executive director, and as I read the amendments, employing such personnel as needed, is creating a new level between the governor and the board that he appoints, followed by a post-secondary education opportunity commission, yet another level of bureaucracy standing between the governor and the board that he appoints, which would, of course, have to employ personnel of its own, and then, according to amendments, call upon these commissions, both the Board of Education and the Board of Higher Education and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, which are underfunded, for additional support to that new commission. And between them, in this scheme of bureaucratic overburden, determine how to allot the relative scarcity of funds for those. We are really have a hard time understanding what would be accomplished if you look at Section 6, Sub 4, Paragraph B of the Dash 2 Amendment and try and figure out what
Excuse me, Mr. We only have the bad one.
I mean, I'd like to make sure I meant Ash 1 amendment.
Still seem to have two things here.
Never heard of that. It's another bill this afternoon. Dash 1 amendment, page 4, line 17.
Sure.
This new commission will take up powers now vested in the Board of Education, Board of Higher Education, and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And I quote, establish guidelines for distributing funds to appropriate agencies and individual institutions. End quote. That is an extraordinary amount of power poured into a single sentence of a state statute. But it unhorses the Board of Education, the Board of Higher Education, and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission by drawing up from them to a new commission under the direction of a new education policy office, the distributions of funds to appropriate agencies and individual institutions. And so I would ask, on behalf of the Chancellor, what is broken in the present arrangement that we need such a dramatic fix, and one which, if we were stepped into, might find ourselves sinking well below water in a very deep sinkhole. Let me stop there and say there is nothing in statute now to prevent the governor, whether he or she wishes to direct a complementary budget for these agencies. All three of these agency budgets are contained in the budget she or he put forward. That power is very strong. These are commissions appointed by that government. Do we need to create two new intermediary levels of educational bureaucracy in order to achieve something that is now vested in the office of the governor and a unified gubernatorial budget? I'd like to finish up, Mr. Chairman, by saying that we are deeply concerned about the issue of governance. You are setting aside a 177-page bill, which has at its heart the creation of a new scheme of governance for Oregon post-secondary education. That's not in this bill, except that the door is propped open to this. Yes, people were scared of that 177-page bill. We are just as concerned over Dash 1 amendment, page 3, subs 2 and 3, and section 5. Where what is taken out of the bill is now the door is opened up to examine that during the interim. So all that you may not like in the printed bill is available to this commission in the interim and beyond in order to create. Mr. Chairman and members, the university system has just completed a decade of reengineering, which is, in the United States of America, outstanding. Beginning with the 2010 Advisory Commission vision for higher education, it's not a bill number, but the year 2010, visioning where higher education, public post-secondary education will be in Oregon in the year 2010, setting a roadmap to accomplish that, and doing it through a number of steps. First, with Senate Bill 271, the Higher Education Administrative Efficiency Act, making our business very efficient and very entrepreneurial. Senate Bill 919, which in statute gave the first state agency the first performance and assessment goals in the state of Oregon, and which we came to you and partnered with you in accomplishing that. Following on that, the adoption of a resource allocation model, which creates a new, much more autonomous system, very entrepreneurial post-secondary education institution. And to quote the board president, Mr. Don Van Leeuwenay, our board was also president of Electro Scientific Industries and also a member of the Oregon Business Council Board, said the problem that we need to fix is the allocation of public resources to very lean and efficient and customer-focused post-secondary system, not layer it with new levels of oversight, administration, and policy, throw everything into a common pot, and then let a perpetual biennial discussion involve you over how to accomplish the division of it. And just a little history lesson, because as a history major, boy, went wrong somewhere along the line. have to remember that very often everything that we suggest has been looked at in the past. We have a Board of Higher Education and a Office of the Chancellor because in the years leading up to their creation, this body, the legislature, found itself on the receiving end of an hellacious amount of lobbying, log rolling, combinations, and other kinds of things, seeking separate appropriations for separate institutions. The legislature finally said, enough, and created a Board of Education. When the log rolling, the combinations, and the self-aggrandizement continued, they created the Chancellor's Office. And they wrote into law 351.110, relationship with the legislature. All relationships and negotiations between the state legislature and its various committees and the institutions of higher education shall be carried on through the Department of Higher Education. No subordinate official representing any of the separate institutions shall appear before the legislature or any committee, except upon the written authority of the State Board of Higher Education. Put a stop to it, and we haven't used that in years and years and years and years and years. But if you want to find out what it was like prior to the creation of the Office of the Chancellor and the State Board and the rationalization of the administration of your seven institutions of post-secondary education, open the door to government. Try a new scheme that's been tried before, where we came from, 70 years ago. Relearn the history. I would suggest you don't really want to go there. And instead, we ought to say, Governor, won't you please put forward a rationalized and coordinated post-secondary education budget among these three entities and keep a good working system working without running across all of the jurisdictional lines, not just the university system, but I think you're going to hear from the community colleges, and accomplish probably more trouble than it's worth. The voice of history, and we have a new idea which we've tried before, and maybe we'll see whether it works this time. Chairman, I can answer the question you might have.
Senator Marchette. Thank you. Granting there is a bill, House Bill 3803, that would create a quality higher education commission to take a comprehensive look at the needs of higher ed in general. It would establish a advocacy group that would then come to the legislature and make a case for the needs of higher ed, much as the quality education model for K-12 and the legislature would do the same for community colleges. Is that something that you can support?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, yes, I think that would be most helpful. Speaking for myself as an agent of the university system, having cleared this with the Chancellor of the Board, it would be most helpful to have that kind of an examination and recommendation. But we don't need to go to governance as much as we need to go to what is the goals of the system, how do we accomplish them, and tease out the need that way, as opposed to saying, in advance what the solution is and then applying it whether there's a problem or not. Yes, I would go farther and say it would be nice to have explicit as opposed to implicit in the ballot measure one, which was adopted last year, clear statement that a uniform system of public post-secondary institutions is an obligation of this body too. And then we'd have equal footing and say that in a modern world, pre-K to post-grad is a system that shall be seamless, complementary, and cooperative, and achieve public goals. That would be most helpful.
Next question.
Representative.
Pardon me. Page 4, line 3. It says, Commission staff shall present to the 73rd Legislative Assembly. That's two bienniums from now, correct?
Yeah.
This is the 71st. Why do we need 4 years for that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, I don't know. I've got to say that the university system, having just put a capstone of resource allocation model on top of a completely re-engineered system of public higher education, not interested in going out and then over the next 4 years spending the dollars necessary to go and see whether we got it or replace it. And what we need to do is look at how is it funded, and how is it funded in relationship to community colleges and student assistance. The Student Assistance Commission is underfunded. We collapsed in terms of the percentage of the tuition the grant covers. We have 11,000 students who have no grant who qualify. Community colleges are now united around having the dollars for all the students. And a funding model which, well, not an entitlement, but more nearly approaches their needs. We applaud that, support it. The university system has adopted a decentralized model for funding. But all three of them are underfunded. Governance doesn't fix funding. Governance adds costs and pushes out into the future the issue of how you're going to do it. So, Chairman and Representative Smith, I have no idea.
Representative Smith, perhaps Harvey
can
answer that question.
Harvey,
would you state your name?
Harvey Matthews from the Speaker's Office.
Thank you.
The thinking was that if the budget was made for next session, this group would come together in the interim, this interim. The budget would have one 2 year cycle to work through, and then any recommendations for any governance changes should be made after that budget has been worked through completely. That's my line. Now, Mr. Grattan Kearns, I would have said if I were you that it would take that long to reach through two levels of this bureaucracy scheme. But I'm stepping on your toes.
Works for me, Mr.
I follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And I'll ask this of the community college people too. Line 4, page 4, line 17, it talks about guidelines for distributing funds to appropriate agencies. What does that do to the autonomy, for instance, of the community college association, the higher education, the scholarship commission? I see those as very different and distinct entities, and I like the individualism. If we're going to create something that puts these together,
Mr. Chairman, President Smith, that is a deep concern. We have a relatively autonomous set of impetus, and I read that to say that some new interposed commission will be making decisions about allocations to institutions. That is extraordinarily chilling to the institutions, and I think you're going to hear directly from the community colleges regarding that thing.
And I will ask that question then, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair?
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kearns. I want to be sure that I understand what you just said. Have you said that the seven-state university system is not for House Bill 2015?
Chairman and Representative Nelson, either in the printed form or the dash one form, that is correct.
Okay, but on 2015, the seven institutions would vote no on 2015. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nelson, that is correct.
And on 2015-1 amendment, what would the seven universities vote?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nelson, it would be the same, following the lead of the board leadership and the chancellor relative to the issue.
So that is a no.
Thank you, Ben.
Mr. Chairman.
Andrea Henderson, Andrea, you had a panel to accompany you. Whoever would like to begin, very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And I'm here today representing the 17 community colleges in Oregon and the official position of the Oregon Community College Association. I wanted to start out by thanking the speaker for his interest in education in Oregon and his concern over the funding system for education in Oregon. And we agree that that is a system that needs to be looked at. However, we are concerned with the direction that this bill is going. I've got with me today two board members from our community colleges, both Marilyn Krauser from the Shemeckita Community College Board, Michael Rose from the Lane Community College Board, and Jerry Berger, from president of Shemeckita Community College. And I'm going to make a couple of brief comments regarding our position and let them tell you far more about community colleges and the impact this would have on community colleges. Essentially, we are concerned with the direction of this bill and its impact on the local control of community colleges. One of the community colleges currently are ranked the number one institution for state services that they provide. And we believe that a lot of that is because of the local control of community colleges, because community colleges are very responsive to the needs of their local communities. And we are concerned with the direction of this bill and the creation of a commission that would determine different types of categorical funding for education and would also distribute the money out to community colleges. And our concern is that that would impact the ability of local community colleges to make decisions in terms of how money should be spent on their campuses and to meet the needs of their community. We are very happy to continue conversations with the speaker and any other party that would like to talk about post-secondary education in Oregon, but we do remain concerned with the direction of this bill. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Marilyn Krauser, who is a board member from Shenandoah Community College and a member of the Oregon Community College Association.
Mr. Speaker, members of the committee, my name is Marilyn Krauser. I have been a member of the Shemeckita Community College representing Yamhill County since 1988. And during my tenure, I have become increasingly convinced that local control is critical to fulfilling the mission of community colleges. I am opposed to Measure House Bill 2015 because I believe it would erode the local control in budgetary matters and keep us from being responsive to our local communities. By law, Chemeketa is a local institution that is required to meet the needs of the people who live around our local area. That's why the college is governed by 7 board members who are elected from within that college district. We know our communities, we care about our communities, and we are accountable to our communities. We run into our constituents every day. We see them in the grocery store, at school events, in our businesses, and in other places in the community. We want to meet the needs of our constituents because they know us and they hold us accountable. In addition to our informal contacts, we also meet with them frequently with our local businesses and other leaders on a more formal basis. We have a large number of advisory committees made up of local business owners and others. The Chemeketa Advisory Committee list is almost as fat as this original bill. Those committees and various other groups make formal recommendations to the board, and together we help develop the needs of our local community. The needs of our local community are very primary when it comes to developing our college budget. I'm afraid that under House Bill 2015, budget decisions will be made by a commission that may not include anyone from our local area. I understand that the sponsors of the bill do not intend to micromanage our college budget. However, even broad budgetary decisions made at the statewide level have a huge impact at the local level and could restrict our flexibility. Oregon's community colleges have a great reputation for being responsive and responding quickly to the needs of our local community. As an example, Chemeketa Community College is now working with former employees of the Agri-Frozen plant, which is recently closed. We moved staff from our campus over to that plant to counsel and advise them. We have also modified the starting of our classes so that they can start immediately and don't have to wait for a new term. That's what we mean by being flexible. I believe that we earn that reputation because we are locally governed and locally focused.
But we do remain concerned with the direction of this bill. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Marilyn Krauser, who is a board member from the Chemeketa Community College and the president of the Oregon Community College Association.
Mr. Speaker, members of the committee, my name is Marilyn Krauser. I have been a member of the Chemeketa Community College representing Yamhill County since 1988. And during my tenure, I have become increasingly convinced that local control is critical to fulfilling the mission of community colleges. I am opposed to Measure House Bill 2015 because I believe it would erode the local control in budgetary matters and keep us from being responsive to our local communities. By law, Chemeketa is a local institution that is required to meet the needs of the people who live around our local area. That's why the college is governed by 7 board members who are elected from within that college district. We know our communities, we care about our communities, and we are accountable to our communities. We run into our constituents every day. We see them in the grocery store, at school events, in our businesses, and in other places in the community. We want to meet the needs of our constituents because they know us and they hold us accountable. In addition to our informal contacts, we also meet with them frequently with our local businesses and other leaders on a more formal basis. We have a large number of advisory committees made up of local business owners and others. The Chemeketa Advisory Committee list is almost as fat as this original bill. Those committees and various other groups make formal recommendations to the board, and together we help develop the needs of our local community. The needs of our local community are very primary when it comes to developing our college budget. I'm afraid that under House Bill 2015, budget decisions will be made by a commission that may not include anyone from our local area. I understand that the sponsors of the bill do not intend to micromanage our college budget. However, even broad budgetary decisions made at the statewide level have a huge impact at the local level and could restrict our flexibility. Oregon's community colleges have a great reputation for being responsive and quick responding quickly to the needs of our local community. As an example, Chemeketa Community College is now working with former employees of the agri-frozen plant, which is recently closed. We moved staff from our campus over to that plant to counsel and advise them. We have also modified the starting of our classes so that they can start immediately and don't have to wait for a new term. That's what we mean by being flexible. I believe that we earn that reputation because we are locally governed and locally focused. Please allow the locally elected board members to continue serving Oregon and serving their communities, and I would urge you not to pass House Bill 2015. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Michael Rose. I represent Lane Community College Board. And after 30 years of working at a community college and now serving on the board, I'm convinced more than ever the importance that the local autonomy and the governance issues that Greg talked about, how important that is for the college and its ability to serve its mission. I remind you that the state mandate says the community colleges must serve the local community, and we have a broader mandate than the university system does. And I would call your attention to that. My major concern as I look at this particular bill is that at a time we're trying to create more cooperation between the university system and the community college system, that this would actually cause more conflict between the two levels of higher education. I am deeply concerned about funding issues, and I don't, you know, I certainly understand the desire for more efficiency in higher education overall. However, I'm not sure when I listen to the testimony that says, you know, you're still going to have the Ways and Means Committee dealing with three different budgets, how that's going to create more efficiency. I think you're going to create more conflict and more turmoil. So I would urge you to oppose 2015. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Backlund, members of the committee, I'd like to start my remarks by taking the advantage of the fact that I came here today and I looked in the back of the room and I saw all kinds of people, and I realized that Dr. Kathy White and students from her class from Chemeketa Community College Schools and Society are here today to observe how policy is made at the legislature and to learn and observe how it operates. So if I could, I'd like to introduce them. They could stand up, and it was just by happenstance, too. It wasn't.
All right. Hey, wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're going to be on good behavior.
And we will plan to give you a report on what they observed and what they learned. Coming last on this panel, it's easy to sum up, and some of the things I was going to say has already been highlighted, so I won't bore you with the same things over and over. But as all of you may be aware, community colleges are very comprehensive, and over 50% of our mission, probably closer to 55% of our mission, doesn't specifically relate to, quote, the university system. Major emphasis on professional technical training, which is 1- and 2-year degrees that prepare people for the world of work. Also, a major part of our mission is adult basic education, basic literacy, ESL, and those types of activities. So when you look at comprehensive community colleges and universities, we have a different mission and a different focus. As the board members articulately said, we are local institutions, and we respond to local needs. In regards to budget, each of the 17 community colleges are mandated in preparation of the budget that the 7 elected board members and 7 appointed citizens serve on local budget committees. That's 17 local budget committees that review in detail what is going to be accomplished with the dollars, what tuition and fees are set, what parts of our mission should we focus upon? What things do we do or not do? And they do that on a yearly basis and give the administration of the college direction as how dollars should be spent, on what they should focus, and they review that on an annual basis. Obviously, the ratings, Oregon Progress Board, community colleges are extremely well respected. People like what they are getting, and they feel that they have a voice, a choice, and can give us direction on a daily basis. If improvements are needed in our governance system, I would urge you to look at the current system, the current structure, and if this does become a major issue, community colleges surely would like to be involved in that process and not just kind of being, oh, by the way, there's some things going here, but if anything does occur, we need to be involved at the beginning of the process, and we need to get our local elected officials involved and college staff to review that before we go any further with this type of initiative. Thank you for the opportunity.
Let's hear more questions.
Andrew, a question for you. We met earlier in the session to talk about a quality education model for community colleges. Would you support that kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette, we would be happy to engage in any conversations regarding community colleges and the mission. And community colleges pride themselves on being very innovative and responsive to change. And we would welcome any opportunity to talk about the role of community colleges and how we can improve them.
Representative Smith, then Representative Barnhart.
Now, Mr. Berger, what would this bill do to the autonomy of Shemekin Community College?
Reading the bill, I believe it could have great impact on the present autonomy that Shemekin Community College
has. How?
Commission perhaps could direct you on how the money should be spent, on what programs it should be spent, which now is a local decision. It perhaps could tell you what staffing levels and what areas, and right now those are the purview of the local board to give direction to those issues.
Probably in staff you really don't know what this commission could tell you because it's not outlined in the bill. Would that be correct?
I believe that is correct. Representative Berkman, Representative Smith, I believe that is correct.
Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had the privilege of sitting in on some of the meetings of the Education Subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee while some of you who were at the table were presenting your budget or portions of your budget and the programs that you operate now. And I have to tell you that even though I thought I understood what community colleges do, I really didn't. In fact, you have enormously broad programs. My sense of the community colleges is that they are enormously entrepreneurial in the sense that they look at local needs, they connect with local businesses, and work to develop programs that are needed in the local communities for the well-being of our citizens, our economy, and our workers. But it strikes me that that is an enormously different mission than the one that we've given to the seven institutions in the Oregon University system, and that many of those have statewide many departments have statewide implications. We have one law school and one medical school, for example, in different institutions. Your comment on how, if you agree with what I just said, one for one thing, and also if you do, what implications does this bill have for those very, very different, apparently very different missions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I would certainly agree with your statement that the community colleges are very comprehensive in their nature, and their programs can be very different from community college to community college as they meet the needs of that community. And frankly, that is one of our concerns in this bill because we are so locally focused. We do have different programs. Some community colleges may have the same program because that's the need of that individual community. Other community colleges will have unique programs to meet the needs of their community. So our fear is that any type of mandates from the state level in terms of what type of services we would provide would have a detrimental impact on that local ability to make decisions.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you, members of our Community College Association, for being here. President Berger, how long have you been associated with Chemeketa?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I've been with Chemeketa Community College since 1974.
Mr. Berger, who was the representative of your college in this plan to develop this prototype of House Bill 2015?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, to my knowledge, no one from the Chemeketa Community College Committee was involved in the development of 2015.
How many Oregon citizens do you serve or have you served over your 30 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not a math major. This past year, we served over 51,000 individuals. We weren't quite that large in 1974. We served 7,000 individuals in 1974. Split it in half, we served hundreds of thousands, at least a million people during that, since 1974. And that's wrong. Please forgive me because I'm trying to do that in my head. We serve a ton of Oregonians and a ton of...
Mr. Chair?
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. And Ms. Rose, how many individuals... did you serve on this program to develop this?
I'm not aware of anyone specifically from Lane Community College serving on the development of this bill.
And follow up, please, to Mr. Chair. And Ms. Rose, would Lane have served as many citizens as Mr. Berger? Ms. Krauser? So you have represented hundreds and thousands of individuals, but yet you weren't part of this program, and probably well should have been, it sounds like. And you, I don't understand the frustration, and I know the developers of this measure, the intent was to simplify a system that apparently has not brought the adequate and proper funding to each of the three areas, higher ed, student assistance, and Chemeketa and Lane and all the other 15 community colleges. So I really appreciate it. Maybe we just need to, look at things from a different perspective. And again, but, that this first step is always important when we're making things better, if they need to be better. But apparently you're doing something very right if you've grown, as much as you've grown, and I recall, and I'll mention it again if it's okay, Mr. Chair, that when the citizens of Oregon were asked what's the number one thing about Oregon that makes you feel warm and fuzzy, the answer of our citizens is our community college, our community colleges. So you're doing something very right, and we certainly should consider your need, and I seem to agree with Mr. Cairns. If it ain't broke, don't fix it and don't mess with it. Maybe fine-tune areas and get us new legislators more up to speed of what has happened to the funding and why and how we can better serve our state, because there's certainly a need, a need for that. And Ms. Anders, Mr. Chair, step aside here. Andrea, would you say that the 17 community colleges supports House Bill 2015?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the 17 community colleges through the Oregon Community College Association do not support House Bill 2115 or the -1 amendment.
Representative Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I almost forgot my name.
No.
Getting
those syllables together for the representative.
I just want to make a comment on local control and flexibility. I thank Chemeketa, and I'm glad they are flexible, because Friday a plant is going to shut down in our neighborhood of Woodburn Agri-Frozen,
right.
And you've got 400 people, and I know they've already worked on a program to... That you're gearing up for it and to help those folks, and I do appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before we dismiss this panel, I need to comment. I've been having a personal debate. I've never known Mr. Rose to be Michael before. To me, he was always Mike. He and I coached football together in the 1960s at Tatum High School.
No way.
He taught me how
to... You're play. Responsible.
Oh, yeah. He taught me how to play chess. We used to do that.
All right.
Yeah. And Mike was a great cook of anchovies, and but anyway, he went from North Salem High School to Lane Community College, and was had a very distinguished career in teaching English. And so I was reacquainted last session with Mike, or today Mr. Michael Rose. And so it's been a nice, refreshing visit to history for me today.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Could I likewise speak about one of these individuals, not even knowing she was going to be here today, but Marilyn Krauser here has been an incredible, dedicated businesswoman to Chemeketa and our community, and our entire community owes her, we're greatly indebted to her, because we have numerous incidents like Representative Zahner's had where we've had... In fact, in the last 2 years, we've had 4 major businesses closed down. And because of the agility of the community college system that's really focused on, in great part, to employment, you know, and I think that's what we've got to be focusing on a lot, because we're the lowest state in job growth right now, and we're number one in food, you know, insecurity. And so I appreciate what Marilyn Krauser and the whole Community College Association and the university system have done in providing jobs. But I just particularly want to speak to Marilyn's contributions to Chemeketa, and certainly in Yamhill County. Appreciate the people you've gotten jobs for and helped retrain, and the English language programs. I just can't say enough for the entire management. Thank you.
Thank you. I've known Jerry for 30 years, too.
Oh, my God.
Your voice changed.
Mr. Chair, I'm extremely pleased to learn all of those new interesting things about one of my constituents, Mr. Michael Rose. I appreciate the information. Very helpful. And I have to tell you that I like him a lot, too.
And finally, Representative Barnhart, Mr. Rose is a University of Oregon graduate, and he did play football.
Even better.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gary Undine, please.
Good morning, Chair Backlund. For the record, I'm Gary Andine, Executive Director of the Oregon Independent College Association. Here with me this morning, Tom Heineson, a member of the State Board of Higher Education, who would also like to piggyback on my sign up, if you will. And I believe we're hoping that Duncan Wise will be here momentarily from the Oregon Business Council. He's had a late start in Portland a few minutes ago. I'm here on behalf of those institutions in the state who invented the concept of autonomy, if you will. And we are in favor of this legislation. In a time of term limits and shrinking public budgets for higher education, along with a growing need for broader and broader access to more and more diverse higher education options, it seems imperative that statewide post-secondary education policy and budget needs to be carefully formulated outside the rushed and raucous setting of a legislative hearing room. And it seems obvious that legislators need assurance that the policy advice they are being given is coming from higher education specialists and public commissioners who are not responsible for the governance of any institution, but who are solely concerned with the post-secondary needs and aspirations of all Oregonians, be they individuals, communities, or enterprises, be they public or private, be they rich or poor, be they noisy or silent. From such a commission as the one proposed in this legislation, from that kind of a setting, the governor as well as the legislature could anticipate expert and unbiased advice on how to deploy the entire post-secondary education resources of the state to the maximum benefit of all Oregonians. Such a neutral setting could provide a voice on behalf of underprivileged and first-generation Oregonians for whom post-secondary education in Oregon isn't even a dream, let alone a benefit for which they would come to the statehouse and demand. Such a setting could propose a balanced financial access scenario, as Representative Morissette mentioned earlier, factoring together public and private tuition policy, availability of public and private funds at different kinds of institutions, differential student and family resources, and the plethora of federal, state, institutional, and private aid programs that target different populations of students with various forms of grant, loan, work, and now tax benefit aid. Given all those variables, and the public and private dollars involved, which are substantial, this is a good time for Oregon's public policymakers to become better informed about the most effective and cost-efficient public means of assuring financial access for all to higher education in this state. Such a setting could be a spawning ground for interinstitutional and intersector collaborations. It could be a place where conflicts are settled and where problems and ideas bigger than any one institution or any one sector can be pursued on behalf of the state as a whole. Whichever way the May 14th forecast goes, this legislature will authorize more than $1.5 billion in state and local taxes for higher education this coming biennium. For this kind of an investment, the legislature and the people deserve comprehensive, consistent, independent, professional, and unbiased planning and advice. We urge passage of the DAC 1 amendments and respectfully suggest that a realistic budget for this undertaking is to be provided by the legislature. That's a broad overview. Let me give you a case in point example that brings it more home to the immediate situation. Oregon's independent post-secondary education community, 16 institutions, an extremely important and valuable resource to the state of Oregon and its citizens. This sector of higher education represents a $500 million a year investment industry, an industry that is environmentally friendly and phenomenally productive for the state when measured in educational terms, in cultural terms, and in economic terms. It provides attractive college options to some 18,000 Oregonians, many of whom would otherwise have to leave the state to pursue their chosen career and education paths. And it attracts to Oregon's communities and to Oregon's workforce an almost equal number of talented young people from other states and foreign countries. By any other name, were such an industry considering to make Oregon its home base, it would be relentlessly pursued and lavished with careful attention by state government. Yet, unlike in many other states, there is no structure within state bureaucracy in Oregon for integrating this substantial independent education resource into any statewide plan for meeting the higher education needs of Oregonians now or in the future. Indeed, there is no overarching statewide post-secondary education planning process of any kind in Oregon for inventorying the state's complete higher education resources, the comprehensive higher education needs of Oregonians, or the fundamental public policy challenges and opportunities that exist for strengthening the scope and size of our total post-secondary education enterprise. When OUS released its institutions into an entrepreneurial model and froze their tuitions, no concern was raised about how this aggressive enrollment and pricing strategy might impact the programs and the viability of Oregon's independent colleges and universities. Yet they are totally dependent on enrollment and tuition income for their survival. With no state legislature to underwrite a substantial portion of operating expenses or to cover the cost of a tuition freeze. Who will now ask, and who will even think it is important that the state consider whether current OUS enrollment increases are at the expense of Oregon's independent institutions, and if so, how those institutions are coping. This is the kind of broad state-level concern we hope would evolve in creation of proposed post-secondary education opportunity commission. It is the kind of concern that balances public policy in ways that at least acknowledge the desirability of preserving an existing healthy private sector. To use a more familiar Oregon analogy, it is a public policy that values and preserves wild salmon even as it floods the streams with hatchery fish. Thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
I have a quick question.
Do
you think this legislation will enhance or possibly give an equal footing to the independent colleges?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we would hope that that would be a step in that direction. We don't ever anticipate an equal footing.
Thank you. In the middle of the second page of your remarks, you indicate that there's no overarching statewide post-secondary education planning process. This bill goes way beyond a planning process, does it not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnett, I was party to the conversations in the Speaker's office that have evolved into the -1 amendments. I don't think anybody anticipated reinventing the governance of higher education in Oregon. We anticipate an examination of whether the governance is as it should be. I think the image that most frequently came to my mind of the governance question was whether our state universities ought to look more like our community colleges, not the other way around, whether they ought to have their own commissions, their own boards to manage their operations, or whether there ought to be some central coordinating agency that looks at how we distribute the state's resources and account for the state's resources and get the most mileage out of them.
Thank you, a follow-up. But the reality is that this measure goes way, way past the business of evaluating and commenting, doesn't it? Isn't it well into the area of governance itself in this measure?
Mr. Chair,
it certainly appears to be from the language of it.
I do not believe it is. And if it feels that way to you, then I think words need to be changed so that it is indeed an advisory body that can bring good ideas to that back to you, the legislature, in the next biennium and two biennia, if you will.
One more follow-up, if I may. So the intention then was not to set up a new governance system superimposed on top of the ones we've already got, but rather to establish a group that would study and do some planning.
Mr. Chair, Representative,
presumably with recommendations to the legislature or the governor or somewhere.
That clearly has been my interest in this legislation. The two gentlemen to my right will have far more focused comments on that particular question.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, excuse me. What's your going?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randine, in your comments, you say that for $1.5 billion in state and local tax investment, the legislature and the people deserve comprehensive, consistent, I'm quoting it here, independent, professional, and unbiased planning and advice.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. In the middle of the second page of your remarks, you indicate that there's no overarching statewide post-secondary education planning process. This bill goes way beyond a planning process, does it not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnett, I was party to the conversations in the Speaker's office that have evolved into the -1 amendments. I don't think anybody anticipated reinventing the governance of higher education in Oregon. We anticipate
an examination of whether the governance is as it should be. I think the image that most frequently came to my mind of the governance question was whether our state universities ought to look more like our community colleges, not the other way around, whether they ought to have their own commission, their own boards to manage their operations, and whether there ought to be some central coordinating agency that looks at how we distribute the state's resources and account for the state's resources and get the most mileage out of them.
Thank you, a follow-up. But the reality is that this measure goes way, way past the business of evaluating and commenting, doesn't it? Isn't it well into the area of governance itself in this measure?
Mr. Chair,
it certainly appears to be from the language of it.
I do not believe it is. And if it feels that way to you, then I think words need to be changed so that it is indeed an advisory body that can bring good ideas back to you, the legislature, in the next biennium and two biennium, if you will.
One more follow-up, if I may. So, mm-hmm. so the intention then was not to set up a new governance system superimposed on top of the ones we've already got, but rather to establish a group that would study and do some planning.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Barton. Presumably with recommendations to the legislature or the governor or somewhere.
That clearly has been my interest in this legislation. The two gentlemen to my right will have far more focused comments on that particular point.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, excuse me. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randine, in your comments, you say that for $1.5 billion in state and local tax investment, the legislature and the people deserve comprehensive, consistent, I'm quoting you here, independent, professional, and unbiased planning and advice. Should I infer from your comments that you don't think we're getting that now?
Chair, Representative Nolan, I think you're getting what every Cumberland College president wants to present to his or her funders, whether they be public agencies or private donors, and that is the best possible picture of all the wonderful things that our institutions do. I'm not sure that you're getting thoughtful commentary on the state's post-secondary education needs in the broadest sense.
Follow-up. And Ms. Randine, don't you think that's the responsibility of the State Board of Higher Education?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, I think that's the responsibility. I think the responsibility of the State Board of Higher Education is to govern seven institutions, to look out for the interests of those seven institutions, to garner as much public support, both monetary and otherwise, for those institutions. I don't know who, other than the governor and you, when you are in session, is specifically thinking about the post-secondary needs of Oregon at large, of Oregonians at large, of needy Oregonians, of out-of-work Oregonians, out-of-rural Oregonians, and the state institute, the OUS system comes in and talks about if students, if needs, if opportunities. It's not coming in and telling you about community college opportunities and needs. It's clearly not coming in and telling you about the needs and opportunities and accomplishments of the state's independent institutions. The community college is the same thing on their behalf. I think it's time that you availed yourself of some thoughtful analysis of what the state's long-range interests and needs are for all of its post-secondary education resources.
Mr. Chair. Excuse me.
One quick final follow-up. With all due respect, Ms. Randine, I do think it's the responsibility of the State Board of Higher Education to look at all of that and not just to have the role of cheerleader for individual institutions. And if we have a problem with how they're doing their job, I think the communication needs to be to the governor to appoint people who are more responsive to the statutory requirements, and to the legislature to not confirm people who aren't doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Nelson, then Representative Morica.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Andine, thank you for being here. When you talk about Independent College Association, whom are you talking about?
Mr. Speaker, Representative Nelson, the Oregon Independent College Association is a 33-year-old organization that represents all the independent, nonprofit, regionally accredited Oregon colleges and universities. Linfield, George Fox, Lewis and Clark, Willamette, City Northwest College of Art, Reed, and so on.
So, Mr. Chair, so we're talking, the independent colleges, we're talking about our private colleges.
Yes, ma'am.
In the state, which are absolutely outstanding. And Chair Backlund and I certainly would agree, since we would have ties to one of those each. Or more, I guess you may.
No.
Were you invited to be a part of this planning process? Or did you...
That represents me, yes, ma'am, I was.
And did the Independent College Association initiate this exercise?
Chair Representative Nelson, no, we did not.
And so when you were involved in this with Mr. Weiss and others, did anyone ask to bring in the Community College Association?
Chair Representative Nelson, the Community College is board representative by the Community College Commissioner, Pam Poyes-Brawley. Pam is in the room today.
I see. And but individuals of, you know, different independent colleges, did they come in and present their view of what was happening in their communities? And
Chair Representative Nelson, no, I represented their interests.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary, first of all, I have a great deal of respect for Gary Andine. I worked with him last session in bills, and I served on the interim committee that dealt with the financial aid, and have worked with Gary and respect what he's done, and I was interested in his response to Representative Nolan's question about the state of funding for higher ed and community colleges, how we lack a coordinated effort. And I guess I would ask if you think that are you familiar with the quality education model for K-12? It has been proposed that there is a quality education model for community colleges and a quality education model for higher ed, which would consist of advocacy groups, people from the community colleges, for instance, people from the business community, citizens who would look at the total need of the community college system and come in to the legislature and make a case for funding of community colleges, rather than each community college coming in or these community colleges themselves. The same would be true of higher ed, which have different needs. Now, that is a different approach to a coordinated effort to get a handle on what is going on in each of those two educational units. So you would have then a quality education model for K-12, a quality education model for community colleges, and a quality education model for higher ed. That would give some consistency to those three levels of educational institutions, and hopefully some overview and consistency to the funding mechanism. You think something like that would benefit the community colleges and benefit higher ed?
Chair Representative Morissette, thank you for the kind comments. Yes, I think any family have more advocacy for any piece of higher education benefits in the long run. Some of you know that my principal advocacy in this building is on behalf of low-income Oregonians, regardless of where they go to college. And those are not the Oregonians who are going to have time or resources to be down here walking the halls, meeting with you, holding rallies on the front steps. Those are the students who are the private students, in fact, the silent majority of college people in the state. Many of them are not college people. They're high school dropouts who never had a college degree.
know, people who can't afford to go to college, people who are attracted to out-of-state institutions where there is better student aid than there is in Oregon. I'm mostly concerned about advocating on their behalf, about advocating on the behalf of a lot of other people who don't come into the hearing room when the $1.5 billion higher education budget is being heard.
Excuse me, Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, the budgets of the state university system and the community colleges are essentially transparent. They're available for review and perusal by the public. And of course, under our Freedom of Information laws, anybody can get what information they need about those budgets. And it sounds to me, as you've been describing the thinking here about this proposal, that you want this commission to be able to review the entire resources in the state for higher education. Will you be recommending to the independent colleges that they make their books and papers equally available and transparent for the purposes of this planning process?
Chair Representative Barnhart, all the independent nonprofit colleges in the state are already public entities, and their books are open to the public.
Thank you.
I think probably I should remind everyone that the time is kind of slipping away, and we have this bill and this bill, and we have some other people who would like to talk. So.
Just one little quick question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Andine, thank you. Now, how many independent colleges did we have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, there are 16.
16. And our total
is about 30,000 students.
30,000. So that's quite a few individuals over many, many years. Do the 16 independent colleges with the 30,000 students, do they support 215?
Chair Representative Nelson, in concept, yes. They have not all seen the actual final words, and certainly not the Cash 1 amendments, which are just very recent, but in concept, they are all committed to this approach.
So when would we know if they're definitely committed to us or not?
Chair Representative Nelson, I believe they have empowered me to speak on their behalf.
Excuse me?
They have empowered me to speak on their behalf.
So you would say that they are totally for 2015?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, they are in favor of the concept of the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay, but not 2015. No on 2015.
That is correct.
And yes on Dash 1. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today on my own behalf, although just to let you know how my perspective on this legislation is formed, I've been a member of the Board of Higher Education for the last 6 years. I've served as president of the board and currently serve as chair of the Budget and Finance Committee. And I support the thrust of the Dash 1 amendments that are before you today. They really deal to me with two issues that are very important with respect to the post-secondary system. The first of those is the budget, and has been discussed earlier several times, so I won't go into detail. The Oregon University system has developed a new student-centered approach to budgeting that I think holds great promise for the state. And I think it sends the right messages to the institutions which participate. But I'd also underscore that it is only board practice at this point. It's simply something that the board came up with for the last session and has utilized again this time. And I think it's worth having the kind of review of the overview that would take place with the commission that would be created under this legislation. I also think it's even more critical that we get a better look across the sectors of post-secondary education for budgeting purposes, which this legislation would provide. after all, it's taxpayers' dollars that we're talking about, and decisions have to be made, whether they're in the governor's office or whether they're before the legislature, about how those are allocated. And I think the current system is somewhat balkanized in how we do that. And somewhere along the line, we need to have a better way of deciding, does the next dollar go into the OUS student-centered model? Does it go to general fund support for community colleges? Does it go into the student assistance, the scholarship funds that have been referred to? I think that we need to try to get apples and apples comparisons about how these dollars could be utilized, and I think that the approach of this bill would help to bring that about. With respect to governance, I think the issue there is really probably more critical within the Oregon University system. I participated in one of the sessions where this legislation was discussed when it was being put together, the amendments were being put together, and I don't think there was ever a sense that we were talking about community college governance. We were talking about within the Oregon University system, and this is an issue which our board struggled with a couple of years ago and really hasn't resolved yet. But the budget, the kind of budgeting that we now do creates a system of universities that are more autonomous, and you'll hear the word semi-autonomous a lot when we talk about this. I think we need to do a little better job of determining what semi-autonomy is, and in particular whether we ought to have local governing boards for the institutions in the Oregon University system. And this approach and this legislation would really allow an examine of that on an institution-by-institution basis, which I think is an important thing to do. I don't think it should be threatening to people. I think the final decisions on these things will rest with the legislature. I would make one recommendation, I think, that might allay some of the concerns with respect to the new commission that would be created, and that is that it ought to be a temporary commission. That is, it could serve for the period of time that's contemplated in the legislation for the work that needs to be done, and one of the issues that then be decided, along with other recommendations received by the legislature and the governor, is whether we need something like that to continue, something that helps provide some coordination among the Oregon University System Board, the community colleges, and the Student Assistance Commission. And that would simply be then another one of the study elements that's included in the legislation. But generally, I think that the Ashland amendments represent a very thoughtful approach to the issue, and I support them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question. I guess if there's really a pressing need for this kind of a comprehensive review of all higher education, is there anything stopping the board right now from not only allowing but encouraging that process?
Well, with Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, with respect to the budget process, there is not a legal impediment to having more collaboration among the elements that are included in the legislation. Our board has jurisdiction over the Oregon University system. We have, frankly, I think, done a better job the last few years in having joint board meetings occasionally with the Board of Education, in which community college and higher ed issues are discussed, but that hasn't been really in terms of the budget. So I think that the office that would be set up in this that brings all this together, including the scholarship side of it, would ensure that it gets the kind of intention, involvement from citizens and others that is appropriate for an enterprise of the size that we're talking about. I think it's worth trying to do for the next budget cycle, and then maybe we make permanent decisions about how this ought to be done. But it is not happening in that way currently.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council, and I want to thank the committee for having the hearing today. And I'd really like to thank Speaker Simmons for facilitating the conversations that have gone on around this legislation. I know this is a difficult subject. I know any time you get into governance, great passions arise and concerns arise, and I strongly appreciate that. And what I'd like to do is walk you through what I think this does. And I heard the testimony earlier, and I think if some of the things that this bill did would happen, I would be opposed to the legislation. And I don't think it's what the intent. I know it's not the intent. And so I would like to give you the rationale and what we're trying to do. And if it needs modification, to make that clear, we need to do it. These amendments have only been out a day, and I think if we digest what they do, I think we're going to learn this is actually a fairly modest step in delivering the kind of higher ed system that we're already moving towards in the state system, the community college system, and in the independent college system. We at the Business Council started this about 4 years ago when we conducted a study, Higher Education and the Economy. And we took a look at the entire post-secondary education system, and you're viewing folks throughout it. And what we saw were three vast changes that are going on in post-secondary education. First of all, you've got exploding demand for post-secondary education services from early adulthood all the way through life. Huge demand for a whole variety of new kinds of services. Second big development we saw was growing competition. A lot of new players are entering this market and scrambling it up in a whole variety of new and different ways to meet learner needs throughout Oregon. The third big change relating to the second is the system is getting scrambled up. You're seeing in Oregon right now four-year colleges operating on community college campuses, and independent colleges working with public universities in a whole variety of ways, which is blurring the lines between community colleges, public universities, and private universities. Add that with internet-based services across state borders, a whole blurring of the line. The question we asked is, do we have the framework to enable all Oregonians to have access to post-secondary education, and do we have a framework that stimulates tremendously creative responses to needs in our post-secondary environment? As we looked at it, we saw three major issues at the time. One is we had to recognize that we have scarce dollars here at the state level. We can't fund everything everybody wants to do in post-secondary education, much as we would like. We have to make choices. And the state policy issue is where we need to make choices. The second issue, as we looked at the system, was the state university system in particular had at the time a very cumbersome governance process. It took a long time for new program approval, a very, very weak incentives for responding to the demands of individual customers, if you will, or clients, or however you want to describe it, to develop new programs. So we came up with a set of recommendations at the time, and I'm very proud to say the university system and the entire higher education community over the last 4 years have responded incredibly well to those recommendations. Under the board leadership and Joe Cox and others, you've seen a decentralization and a new funding model in the university system. You've seen the community colleges with a new funding model, much more responsive. The vision we had in the task force, and I think it's the vision most everyone shares, is the state role is one of allocating dollars based on student enrollment, and individual campuses have much more autonomy for making decisions and choices on what programs to offer, who to, how to serve, and what to do, how to budget. So when I hear the community colleges, for example, describing the need for independence, I wouldn't disagree. That was when we looked at the model for what we thought the world of higher education was going to be like in the future, the community colleges come right to mind. Independent boards, flexible, nimble, that's the kind of environment we're trying to create for the post-secondary community. So that's the direction I think Oregon is moving. I think we should be very proud. What this bill does is really facilitate that direction in moving that direction forward. What it does, and it does it in basically the most significant way is by looking at the budget. We in the state system has done a great job in developing a new funding model to organize by access students with the cell values that specifies how much is spent at freshman, sophomore, junior years, and it allocates based on student enrollment. But that model has not been integrated with a very similar model with the community college system. So you could start seeing what the choices are between community college access, four-year access, and you can start looking at how much you're paying at different levels of education. What this would simply do is ask to have a comprehensive budget presented to the legislature based on the new funding model that looks at everything at once and makes decisions all at once. That's the fundamental requirement of the bill, is to create a budget, ask the governor to create a budget along those lines. And I think that in itself would be very significant to help you make decisions. It would help reinforce the new funding model that the state system has put in place and put you on record that you support this framework for budgeting. That's the requirement of the bill. The second thing the bill does on governance is simply ask some questions about what is the long-term governance structure going to be like in Oregon. It doesn't resolve any of that. It asks the commission to take a look at those issues and come back with recommendations. But that's down the road. That would be for the next legislature. I think we all heard clearly when the original bill came out, don't change the board and commission structure now. I think it's a natural question to ask as you think about the way the environment in Oregon is going. But it doesn't presume anything. The one thing, again, I would argue strongly, and if you needed to put this in the bill, I would completely agree, you should not change local autonomy and community colleges. I think that would be a huge mistake. And if you need to say that up front, that's by that concern. We believe, at least I think everyone who's been participating in this question agrees, that decentralization and flexibility is very important. I would also stress this is not about setting any school budget. It's about setting a funding menu that directs dollars based on student enrollment. So that's what it does. I would agree with Tom. It should be a 2-year commission. I wouldn't make it permanent. I think that commission would come back to you to take a look. And you'd have another chance to examine what the right governance structure is after they've had a chance to take a look at the current system and make recommendations to you. The big thing I think it does is help reinforce the budgeting process that's already emerging and allow you, I think, to get a clearer, more full picture of how the dollars are being spent and be able to make clear and probably, I think, more effectively make choices for the system. So that's what it's about. And again, I would love to work with anyone again on improving and perfecting the legislation.
Thank you. Mr. Wisner, I take it that you don't support the -1 amendments, at least to the extent that it sets up a permanent commission with 4-year term reappointments and all those things.
I think when we talked about this, we just got these yesterday, but my understanding personally, and this is just me, a group of us got together, Gary and Joe Cox and Cam and others, I was thinking this as a 2-year, a temporary. To get the new budget process set up, and that, again, the requirement of the bill is that the governor present a consolidated comprehensive budget using the principles of the new funding model. It would not tell the community colleges how to distribute acceptance as it does now. I mean, the governor gives guidance, you give guidance on distribution formulas, but it basically sets the parameters as we do now. But it simply sets up, it requires that there be a consolidated budget, and I think imprints the new model in fashion and gives your blessing to the new way of doing business. And then it would report back. We'd hope to have a very open, full discussion of governance that you've heard earlier. I mean, I would hope that the commission would engage the entire state of Oregon on what the right governing model is for the future. But it doesn't change governance at this stage, where I would picture it. And again, if you wanted to make it a 2-year, that was what I was thinking about in the first place. And I think that's where we were.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Weiss, I probably should have asked this question of Mr. Matthews when he was up here, but since he's no longer here, you get to catch this one. Was anyone from the Governor's Office of Educational Policy involved in the work group?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I've talked with the governor's office about this.
But Jean Thorne wasn't.
Talking with Jean. She wasn't in.
She wasn't in the work group or anything.
No.
And I don't want to ask you to speak on behalf of the governor, but I'm interested.
Never do that.
since it seems to me the governor could do this, what you've described, not within the bill or the -1 amendment, the governor could set up an advisory panel with the stroke of a pen, and you don't need us. So the fact that he hasn't done that, I'm inclined to interpret to mean this particular governor thinks that he's getting enough advice, probably more than he wants. So as it's sort of boiled down to a much simpler proposal, I now start to wonder why we need to even get in the act.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I think you, the legislature, have a huge interest in getting the governance and the budgeting system of higher education correctly done. And I think one of the challenges... So that's what it does. I would agree with Tom, it should be a two-year commission. I wouldn't make it permanent. I think that commission would come back to you to take a look. And you'd have another chance to examine what the right governance structure is after they've had a chance to take a look at the current system and make recommendations to you. The big thing I think it does is help reinforce the budgeting process that's already emerging and allow you, I think, to get a clear, more full picture of how the dollars are being spent and be able to make clear and probably, I think, more effectively make choices for the system. So that's what it's about. And I would love to work with anyone again on moving and perfecting the legislation.
Thank you. Mr. Wiseman, I take it that you don't support the -1 amendments, at least to the extent that it sets up a permanent commission with 4-year terms and reappointments and all those things.
I think when we talked about this, and we just got these yesterday, but my understanding personally, and this is just me, and we could be drafting, the group of us got together, Gary and Joe Cox and Cam and others. I was thinking this is a 2-year, a temporary.
Short term.
To get the new budget process set up, and that, again, the requirement of the bill is that the governor present a consolidated comprehensive budget using the principles of the new funding model. It would not tell the community colleges how to distribute it stuff as it does now. I mean, the governor gives guidance, you give guidance on distribution formulas, but it basically sets the parameters as we do now. But it simply sets up, it requires that there be a consolidated budget, and I think imprints the new model in statute and gives your blessing to the new way of doing business. And then it would report back, and you'd hope to have a very open, full discussion of governance that you've heard earlier. I mean, I would hope that the commission would engage the entire state of Oregon on what the right governing model is for the future. But it doesn't change governance at this stage. I would picture it, and again, if you wanted to make it a 2-year, that was what I was thinking about in the first place, and I think that's where we were.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nolan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Weiss, I probably should have asked this question of Mr. Matthews when he was up here, but since he's no longer here, you get to catch this one. Was anyone from the Governor's Office of Educational Policy involved in the work group?
Mr. Chair, Richard Nolan, I've talked with the Governor's Office about this.
But Jean Thorne wasn't.
She wasn't in
the work group or anything.
No.
And I don't want to ask you to speak on behalf of the governor, but I'm interested.
Do that.
since it seems to me the governor could do this, what you've described, not within the bill or the -1 amendment, the governor could set up an advisory panel with the stroke of a pen, and you don't need us. So the fact that he hasn't done that, I'm inclined to interpret to mean this particular governor thinks that he's getting enough advice, probably more than he wants. So as it's sort of boiled down to a much simpler proposal, I now start to wonder why we need to even get in the act.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you and the legislature have a huge interest in getting the governance and the budgeting system of higher education correctly done. And I think one of the challenges as we move to this new budgeting system is I think it's very important for you to bless the system of the state, the way the state system and the state colleges have crafted it. I think for you it is an opportunity. And I think I would hope as policymakers you would like to see this kind of comprehensive budget presented to you. You can see all the elements. I will pass out afterwards. But I have an illustration so you can get a picture of what the budget would look like under in our policy playbook if you haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very much simpler, easier to understand framework, and again, one that I think will help you see your policy choices much more clearly. And I think you have an interest in asking for that. And again, I would say that the governor has strongly, we worked with the governor of our education task force, and he was very enthusiastic about the direction encourage and compensate for that the direction of the new funding model, been very actively engaged in this. He hasn't, I don't know what his position will be on this, this legislation, but again, I think it reinforces where we've been going and it helps solidify the gains we've already made.
Sure.
If I might have a quick follow-up. And I understand we're past our time. In the course of half-hour, 40-minute discussion, I have seen, and maybe it was because I didn't see it originally, but I believe it's actually evolved as we've discussed it here, from a rather sweeping governance change in the original bill to what we saw when we first arrived with the Dash 1 amendments, and now to an examination of what role post-secondary education plays in our educational system and our economy. And as it's evolved, if I understand that evolution correctly, it's getting to a point where I could be pretty enthusiastic about it. And if I'm interpreting that evolution correctly, I would encourage another go at putting that into words on the page that mean what we've just discussed, and I would suggest that a formal participation by someone in the governor's office would be appropriate at this stage.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, and I think one of the concerns, whenever you bring up initiatives as heated as like this one, and again, with the original amendments, I think there are a lot of concerns. Again, I'm trying to interpret, this is my interpretation of what the amendments were attempting. Other people can speak as well, but again, I think you could overread what's in this bill, and if there are changes, obviously, we may need to amend these amendments. They've just been out a day, and it may not quite connect, and certainly concerns are raised, but that's, I think, what the intent is.
Representative Martin, Representative Nelson, thank you. In response to Senator Nolan's question, and I'll have a quick
question. You're a senator now. Wrong chamber.
Maybe you are.
Maybe I am.
I will be. With Jean Tan from the governor's office concerning the quality education model that is very favorable. She supported the idea of the same kind of program that is now just for K-12. Existing for higher ed. Wouldn't that accomplish the same end as what you're asking, and with no change in governance at all, it would be a comprehensive study of the needs of higher ed by a group including members of your organization and make a recommendation to the legislature which they would have to listen to or explain?
Mr. Chair, Representative Martin, I think they're actually very similar. If you take a look at this bill, what it does, the only thing that's a little different in this bill is it does spell out the categories of the funding categories in the new funding model, which I think is a good thing to have you, the legislature, on record for. But it is very similar. What it asks is for commissions to examine and present a consolidated budget. It would also consolidate the other pieces. It includes independent colleges and community colleges in the state system schools. And health sciences, for that matter, all in one place. So you have the ability to connect across as well. And I think in the world we're going into, that's very important because, as I say, there's a lot of blurring of lines here among sectors. I understand each has a distinct, important role to play, but there are some blurring that would be facilitated by this process.
The other thing, Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette, that I would add is that with respect to the governance issue within the Oregon University system, the governor has asked our board to look at that. We can't make statutory changes. There would be statutory changes necessary if we were to create local boards. And I think this kind of approach would allow the appropriate examination of that and do it on a university-by-university basis and come back and see what's necessary. So I think that element of it you couldn't do, I mean, you can't do without ultimately involving the legislature, and this would be a way of doing it where you have a good study during the interim period. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Weiss, I just want to tell you that I do already know it is my responsibility to look at a comprehensive budget. I mean, that's why I was elected, and that's what we're doing. I just want to make sure that's known because, I mean,
that's our, one of our primary purposes, I believe, for being here, and a lot of citizens hold us fiscally accountable and responsible. When, follow up, Mr. Chair, please. When, from a business viewpoint, I mean, I find it very difficult to think of what we are truly have now done with this complex situation we want to put together. Coming from a holding company with, you know, 23 subsidiary companies, and as administrator of the budget for every one of those companies, plus the holding company, I cannot imagine, you know, taking each uniqueness and meshing them together and coming out into a holding company with anything that makes total sense because they're so unique. So, you know, the 747 operations don't mesh with the helicopter operations, which don't mesh with the ground handling operations. So that's what we appear to have here. And while our focus, I'm glad about the focus, sad about the situation, because I believe that we felt there was, and I still believe there is greater accountability than we're giving our units credit for at this time, and perhaps we can work it out later. But I can no more think of doing this than I could taking all these companies and putting them in one budget, because the account numbers will never match. If that's our problem, they'll never match.
Chair, Representative, I'll come visit you, but I think there's a huge distinction we need to make. Is this is not a proposal for the state to be doing the individual budget in the school. Far from it. The way the state is moving is to allocate its dollars on a per-student basis, just like the community colleges have done for a number of years, where they receive dollars from the state, not based on what their local budgets are, as you're describing, but based on how many students enroll, basically. And that's where the state is going, because it actually simplifies that to the state's job of saying, how much can we afford in terms of access at different stages of life? The money then goes to schools. State school is responsible for its own budget. And under the model that's emerged in the state system, going to the community college system. And that we totally applaud that, because it's exactly for the reason you're saying, it simplifies and allows each school to have the flexibility to create its own budget. And that's what we're trying to accomplish.
Mr. Chair, I just need a follow-up, because that is not what I said. I just want to be sure that's on the record. Any more than, you know, Linfield College is exactly like Willamette. I mean, these are all unique within their, you know, have their specialties, just like, you know, our categories.
Thank you. If we are we losing members here on the front?
We're doing the floor.
Mr. Chair, we're going to have coming up on the floor. How do we want to be there?
Well, we were hoping to move 2598 during this session, and perhaps we can hustle on House Bill 28. So we will recess or close the hearing on House Bill 3278 and open a work session on House Bill 2598.
Janet, would you summarize for us real quick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2598, you have the -4 amendments to change from the amendments that you saw. This creates a special education task force to study funding of special education and programs. The -4 amendments changed what were assumptions in the bill that Representative Starr noted to more study, additional study items, and so that's the change in this bill. The bill does connect with the funding that's in another bill, Senate Bill 519, for the review of special education programs. It's $150,000. We've not heard necessarily from the Department of Education about the original bill cost and what they think that this review will cost, but if it's not more than $150,000, it is from that of Senate Bill 519.
Janet, are we talking about ways and means referral?
The original bill did not have a ways and means referral. This is a gut check, but that is under discussion. And former Representative Lundquist is in the audience, and this is his concept. They're having discussions with Representative Weston on ways and means that he is would try to move the bill if it did go to ways and means.
Ways and means is.
I think that's where we should send it.
Well, I'd entertain, we're in a work session, I'd entertain a motion on the Dash 4.
So moved.
Representative Morissette moves the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2598. Discussion?
Is this Ways and Means?
Yes. Well, yeah.
Without recommendation.
This will be the Ways and Means with the recommendation.
Okay.
This is the Dash 4 that is
right
now. Okay, no objections? Okay, we'll move to Dash 4. Representative Morissette?
I will move House Bill 2598 to Ways and Means as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Morissette moves House Bill 2598 as amended with a due pass recommendation. This would go to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Hopkins?
One quick comment, thank you, Mr. Chair, is that this is included in the $5.2 billion for school funding.
It's a carve-out. However, one of the leading education advocacy groups has recommended that this was something that they would support. And so I guess I would mention that at the same time. Paula, would you call the roll, please?
I didn't think about it.
Yeah, I think you used that term carve out, didn't you?
No.
No. No, she's... Are you voting?
Yes, I'm voting.
Was that a yes vote?
That was a no vote.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Excused?
Sure.
Excused?
Water?
Yes.
Margon?
No.
Hoffman?
Yes.
Aye. Having received the constitutional majority, House Bill 2598 moves to pass and moves to the way it needs to. Cam gone.
Cam's still here.
Where's Cam?
In Harvard.
Cam? Cam here, Harvey? Are you interested in a few more comments? At least one of us I know can stay.
Okay.
You sure? Well, yes, we will not be here in 2020 today. We'll have to push it back. I do want to do that. We have two of you who wanted to testify on 2020.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I can say if you don't mind talking to one pretty empty booth. We'll do this again on a Thursday. You have made an effort. That's been here, and we hate to say, can you come back on Thursday? I don't know if you do.
Is this Thursday?
Yeah, is that right or not?
This will pull up.
Okay. So next Tuesday?
Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, geez. Okay.
We did.
You can do that.
Or you can tap it in.
A tap in is just basically say we're going to open a hearing, we do it, and we close it, and there's no testimony, so
we
can do this later on.
That's
not happening. There's no testimony. We have to do that. In other words, to hear certain House bills, we have to do it all by Thursday.
We can tap it in now.
Okay.
You want to tap it in right now?
It's reading. It's good. Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Okay. Would you like to? Okay, that's fine. Okay. Because we can open the hearing and give testimony for the record, even though I'm on the hearing, public hearing. So I can take that. No. Okay. Yeah, we're standing at ease.
so you're saying you go down the list.
The other thing
I think that maybe I'm going to do more.
Well, we're pretty.
I know, John.
And I said if necessary, you know, we can open the hearing and listen to the public.
Yeah,
that
is.
May I begin the session with an apology. I feel really badly that we've been so patient and it didn't work out to have the full committee here to listen to your testimony, but it is important that you get this on the record, so it will not be wasted, even though it's Representative Hodgson and I who are listening. And a note for the record, we are subcommittee at this point.
Well, thank you very much for allowing us to give testimony. Chair Beckman, my name is Joan L. Craig. I am the director of Mid-Valley Learning Center, which is a school and a center for language learning disabled children, i.e. dyslexia. And I'd like you at this time, Representative Nolan was talking about these funny little symbols on pages, and I'd like for you at this time to take a look at funny little symbols in the back of your package on the left side. This would be about the second paper in the end. And it has funny little symbols on it.
Excuse me, funny
little. Oh, there's your funny little packet with the funny little symbols. And let me just say I am grateful to Mark Simmons to having the forthright sense to see that this bill should be in order. And I'm thankful to be here. As you can see, those funny little symbols, if I asked you to read them, just off the hand, I see some of you laughing, it would be quite hard for you to do so unless I, as a professional special education therapist, help a student to read that, the people who have dyslexia, the children who have a language learning disability. They would not be able to read that. However, I can say that it says, "Come on," said Betsy, "we have to pick up the corn. We don't have another can of popcorn." And I know you can't see that until you actually look. And the reason is, if I may take that, do you have the B? And the B. Thank you. The reason for that concern is because children who have a language learning problem have a problem with this letter. It seems to be a B. And if you turn it this way, then it's a Q. But if you turn it around so you can see it the other way, it's a B, and then it's also a P. So the children who come to us have this specific problem. Not only do the English with the second languages have a problem, but so do our children who have dyslexia. Now, the reason I am here is I'm advocating that this bill be passed for several reasons. One of the reasons is I have a petition here. And this is the concern of many of the students' parents who have dyslexia. One of them is sitting next to me and will give testimony. It's a petition of support for this. And we also have 25 parents who have these petitions. And I was unable to collect them all today because I wasn't there at school. But when I go tomorrow, I will collect them. So we have approximately 400 names. And I believe that this bill should be approved because of the following reasons. This bill gives the parents the right to choose a special education provider who will meet the needs of these children. I ask you to go to the back of your pamphlet again and look at a sheet that looks like this. And as you're looking at it, I would like you to specifically see if you can tell me what it is. Now, we ask children to do that every day in classroom.
But the children who have a specific language learning disability called dyslexia, they can't see that until we as professionals give them the tools to learn how to see what it is. It's a cow. The cow's form is right here. There's his nose, there's his two eyes, and this is the head, and there's an ear. But just so you couldn't see that quickly, a child who has a disability can't see it at all. Still having trouble, I can come on up and show you. Don't feel bad, we couldn't do that either at first. So I would like you to help those children be able to see. Be able to see English, if you will. This bill will help meet their bench levels by providing them with the alternative education options available, as stated in law number 329.485. This paragraph is going to give a list of qualified educational providers, which I like. This will take the guesswork out of which provider the parent should contract with to achieve the goals of the child. Did you know this fact? According to the National Institute of Health, researchers can now consider reading problems a major public health threat. 40% of children across the nation are poor readers. 20% have severe language learning problems called dyslexia. These children need to be identified early and taught in a special way so that they can have success in their everyday lives. The public school system, the traditional school system, does not work for a child that has dyslexia. Without assistance, the dyslexic student will find school frustrating. He's going to fall far behind. Decide he's dumb. He's not going to be able to be a good role model in the classroom when he can't think or read. He's going to be a behavioral problem, and often is. There's no cure. But there are special techniques which we have researched and know that are tried and true to relieve the students of the confusion and disorientation, thereby aiding them in their learning. I'd like to give you an example right now of how hard it is for a student who has dyslexia to think. Pretend you're all in your cars and you're at a red light and you have your foot on the brake. Another car pulls up next to you and it has its person has its foot on the brake. All of a sudden, it starts to move. What do you do? Oh, I must be moving. And you put your foot on the brake, too. Why? Because you got disoriented. The children who have dyslexia get disoriented not just one time a day, but all through the day. As they look at words and can't read them, they get confused. Then, they get disoriented. When that happens, you might as well forget to ask a child with dyslexia to read or to stand up and speak because they can't do that. Only special providers with special training know how to use special methods to teach children with dyslexia. We at Mid Valley Learning Center have studied, researched, and know how to work with these children and have been doing it for 8 years. We have no money funded by the state or by the federal government. The term learning disability, we feel, is a term for the legislature, educational institutes, and for financial purposes only. The child who is dyslexic, he's going to fall under that code. You know, he will. But, as it is written, but he's not helped enough in a special education room with a free educational system because the special education teachers have not been prepared to teach dyslexic children. And I have had many special education teachers come over and say just that, help me. And I have given them the help that they need. The special education rooms have children who have other learning disabilities, which are primarily the result of visual, hearing, physical handicaps, mental retardation, or, you know, emotional disturbance. Sometimes the students may be environmentally, culturally, or economically disadvantaged. But the dyslexic child is of average, above average, and maybe even genius IQ. But because of the gene on the arm of his chromosome number 6, which you know is responsible for him having these distortions, he has what we call dyslexia. Some of them cannot think in order to get the words out. Some of them cannot write. It looks like, doctors, if they're here, doctors writing. And some of them cannot read a simple sentence, run, being run. Without the special tools that specific providers can give them. Because of this unique problem, teachers, parents, and the child himself reach a point where they're all frustrated. They don't know what to do. Parents look for another special education provider, only to find out that their fees, which cover screenings, evaluations, and tutoring, they have to pay for. They don't have the schools to pay for them. Many special education providers receive no state or federal funding. We don't. All fees are paid by the parent. Parents are driven to help their children any way they can, and so they'll do almost anything to help. You would if it was your child. I would if it was my child. So some of them take two jobs to make this happen. The unfortunate thing is that many parents can't afford the tutoring. They lack the resources to take on school systems by filing suits to get public schools to pay for other special education. You. And he has it, the person has his foot on the brake. All of a sudden it starts to move. What do you do? Oh, I must be moving. And you put your foot on the brake too. Why? Because you got disoriented. The children who have dyslexia get disoriented not just one time a day, but all through the day. As they look at words and can't read them, they get confused. Then they get disoriented. When that happens, you might as well forget to ask a child with dyslexia to read or to stand up and speak because they can't do that. Only special providers with special training know how to use special methods to teach children with dyslexia. We at Mid-Valley Learning Center have studied, researched, and know how to work with these children and have been doing it for 8 years. We have no money funded by the state or by the federal government. The term learning disability, we feel, is a term for the legislature, educational institutes, and for financial purposes only. The child who is dyslexic, he's going to fall under that code. You know, he will. But, as it is written, but he's not helped enough in a special education room with a free educational system because the special education teachers have not been prepared to teach dyslexic children. And I have had many special education teachers come over and say just that, help me. And I have given them the help that they need. The special education rooms have children who have other learning disabilities, which are primarily the result of visual, hearing, physical handicaps, mental retardation, or, you know, emotional disturbance. Sometimes the students may be environmentally, culturally, or economically disadvantaged. But the dyslexic child is of average, above average, and maybe even genius IQ, but because of the gene on the arm of this chromosome number 6, which you know is responsible for him having these distortions, he has what we call dyslexia. Some of them cannot think in order to get the words out. Some of them cannot write. It looks like, doctors, if they're here, doctors writing. And some of them cannot read a simple sentence, run, stay, run. Without the special tools that specific providers can give them. Because of this unique problem, teachers, parents, and the child himself reach a point where they're all frustrated. They don't know what to do. Parents look for another special education provider only to find out that their fees, which cover screenings, evaluations, and tutoring, they have to pay for. They don't have the schools to pay for them. Many special education providers receive no state or federal funding. We don't. All fees are paid by the parent. Parents are driven to help their children any way they can, and so they'll do almost anything to help. You would if it was your child. I would if it was my child. So some of them take two jobs to make this happen. The unfortunate thing is that many parents can't afford the tutoring. They lack the resources to take on school systems by filing suits to get public schools to pay for other special education providers, and they're lost. I've had to turn away hundreds of students because the parents don't have the money. I have bartered, so I am bartering blue. I've had people come in and sweep or pile or clean the cobwebs just so their child can come for a session. I have given up a salary last year so that the children can come. I personally can no longer give up my salary, and this bill will help these people choose trained professional or educational therapists who will have a major positive impact on the lives of these students and their parents, and it will be paid for by the state as it should be. Among children identified as learning disabled by the third grade, 74% remain disabled by the 12th grade. Reading problems that are solved by 30 minutes in special education in kindergarten and first grade require 2 hours in third grade. What do you think it does in fourth and fifth? And now we are seeing many students are of the age of 13 to 16. I have one boy who pumps gas so he can come to Miss Al Learning Center and get his education. President Bush said he wants to see every child in America read. Governor Kitzhaber wants to see all children in grades 1 through 3 to be able to read and to have a chance and to have early intervention. I believe this wholeheartedly, that if we have these children start to learn, the ones that have this learning disability, read at this young age and learn, then when they get to be 15 and 16, I wouldn't be seeing them. We have heard testimony here about people who want quality education, and they want accountability, and they want the budget to be right for the older students, for the students in second higher education. Our kids are never going to make it unless we give them this bill. It gives these parents the right to choose a special education provider if the schools are not doing it. I want every parent to have the child to a right to find an educational provider, whether it's me or someone else. Someone who has the expertise to teach their child to read, thereby giving their children confidence and the knowledge to know that they're not dumb. And we have many students who come in. Wyatt was one of them who thought, I'm stupid. He came in like this. And the first day he went out like, hey, Mom, I could beat a rat frogs and I'm not stupid. And frogs is a game that I play with the children to get them to learn focusing techniques. I want everyone to learn to read. I want every child to learn to read, just like President Bush and Kitzhaber and just like you. But they're only going to do that if they have a specific learning tool. And I'd like to refer to you to the tools that are in your packet again, your funny little packet. On the left side, there's a form that's called Distinctive Learning Techniques. And in back of it are pictures of our children using them. This is what makes us different in the special education room. The special education room does not have any of these distinctive techniques. These are techniques that we've researched and know that are tried and true. If you look at the first picture, there's a boy with an alphabet, and he is doing symbol mastery. And that happens to be Wyatt, and his mom is sitting next to me. And he can tell you that he had a hard time learning the alphabet, let alone what was the sequence of their letters, what came first, what came behind it. The second picture is of a girl using intellectual impressionism. And this is Kate the Books, and you'll notice she has a colored overlay. And in your packets, you're going to find you have color sheets, because we found that colored overlays like this and colored sheets help a dyslexic child to see better, to see the words better. There's no distortions. Sometimes we have to have glasses, and in that case, there's tinted glasses like Wyatt has and so many other children to help the distortions go away. We have distortions like rivers and pages, and we have distortions like blurriness or halos of the words. But the child sometimes needs a tinted glass to help them be able to read. It takes away what it is called scotopic sensitivity syndrome. And what happens is the light from above hit a paper, and it's going too fast for the child to take in his eyes, a dyslexic child. So we dim that by providing them with colored overlays or colored glasses that help these distortions go away. I had one child look at me and said, oh my gosh, now the words aren't running together. Another one said, oh, where are the rivers? So we know that this system works. Everything I'm telling you today, I know works. The focusing technique using what we call Ron Davis's mind's eye works. We know that because a child who has dyslexia, the back of their brain in the language area is not working properly. And so we give them the focusing technique to help them to jump chromosome 6 with the right and the left so that they join and can think logically. Most kids who have dyslexia don't have laterality. This is the right of me, this is the left, this is the front, this is the back. Turn them around, now where's the right? They'll say, right here. So we teach laterality exercises, which is the next one on the side, next picture. And we have assistive technology. We only have 3 computers, but we're doing the best we can with those. And we have anyone is welcome to donate anything that they can to our school. We would be more than welcome to have it. So parents who asked me to come today have asked me to stand up for them. They're not just 23 that come to us. There's 400, there's 1,000, there's 2,000. There's people who are out there who cannot afford a special education provider, but their child will never make it to high school unless they have one. So I'm asking you to give Bill 2020 a chance to be voted on and give all our children, not just the remedial room, the kids who are in the remedial room, a chance, but the kids who aren't helped by that remedial room. Those are the ones we would like to see have a chance instruction congruent with their needs. I want you to put the right choice for a provider in the hands of the people, the parents. And with this, I'm asking you to put the vote as it is. And now I'd like to introduce Susan Brown, who has been waiting patiently, and I want you to know this is her first time here. And she has agreed to come with me and explain to you what it's like for her son, Wyatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hobson and Representative Ashton, thank you very much. I had a speech all wrote out, but I'm not going to read off of it. Some of the things that I would like to mention is that my husband and I both, we have 3 children that are dyslexic. Our oldest son is an 11th grader in Lebanon High School, and our daughter is a 9th grader at Lebanon High School. Our youngest, Wyatt, is a 5th grader, and he is now going to the Mid Valley Learning Center, and we're also homeschooling him as of this last December. Wyatt was tested in the public school system and was under an IEP at his school. I'd just like to give you a few statistics on that. When he was in the 3rd grade, his basic reading level was at 1.2 grade level. His spelling was at 1.6, and his written language was at 1.2. Wyatt wasn't too frustrated at this point in the 3rd grade. He knew that his fellow classmates were higher than him, but he wasn't frustrated yet. Well, then by the end of the 4th grade, so this has been a whole year, actually 2 years, all of 3rd grade and 4th grade, Wyatt was still reading 1st grade sight words, still working on them, trying to get those down, and he worked extremely hard at this. His score for his spelling was at 2.0, which at the beginning of the 4th grade was 2.6, so he actually dropped. And I'm not sure, Joan might be able to explain that a little better than me, but so by the end of the 4th grade, he was extremely frustrated. So we started the 5th grade, and his frustration level was extremely high. He was having a hard time with the assignments he was given, and the length of time he was given to complete his assignments was impossible for him. I was called to the school 2 different times because he was so upset and crying. So, excuse me.
This is a very emotional time for parents, and I was lucky I got one to say that she would come.
I'm sorry. Anyway, I knew as a parent that it was time to do something because he was not getting the help he needed. I was trying at home as best I could, and it just was not working.
So I found out about Jones Center, and I took my son there. And as soon as I walked to her building, I happened to see this little red booklet, and I believe you put something in your packet. And I was, while I was waiting to speak with Joan, I flipped through this pamphlet. And it's easy read, you know, I flipped through it fairly fast. And I couldn't believe it. Someone understood my child. He understood that he was, and he wasn't stupid. At the last conference that I attended, thank you, Bill. At the last conference I attended at our public school, I was told he was lazy and cocky because he wasn't finishing his assignment. And I knew this was not true. This is a young man who wanted to learn. He loved school. Well, his previous teacher said he worked hard. He was a hard worker. Well, he was a hard worker because he had to. Just to be where he was at, he had to work so hard. So I was so excited. We got Wyatt tested in December. He started attending the Mid Valley Learning Center immediately. And I took him out of school so I could give him extra help at home. Because what happens with these dyslexic children is their mind works so much harder than the normal, so-called normal, brain. That by the time they're done with 6.5 hours of school and they come home and they have assignments they haven't completed in school, they can't sit. They cannot focus on what they need to do. And it was a fight. And I didn't understand this as a parent. But I have this word to show. You have a lot of patience with these children. And Wyatt, as you can, as Joan was mentioning, and I did not know this as a parent, and I felt so bad. He could not recite his alphabet in the fifth grade. Now, I knew in the first and second grade, you work on your alphabet. I helped him at home. He got to the letter F and could not go any further. Within 3 weeks of doing the clay mastery, which he's doing up here, he could recite his alphabet. He could recite it backwards and forwards.
She really does mean backwards.
And I mean backwards, starting at Z. And I would have to look at it to do it myself, but he could do it. He learned how to do the mind's eye, which it is so phenomenal, I cannot explain. One day he wrote a sentence. He done his mind's eye, he wrote a sentence. It was perfect. He had capitalization, he had punctuation, he spelled the words correctly. We had a break, we had lunch, he went back to work. You could not read what he wrote. And I was absolutely amazed. So I guess as a parent, I am an advocate for my child and all the other children out there that are having these difficulties, that it would be great to have some funding for them. I, as a parent at this point in time in my life, can afford to send my child there. 5 years ago, I could not have done this. And I know there are a lot of parents who would love for their children to have these wonderful techniques that Joan at her center knows and other people can learn to do. And I hope you guys take into consideration that this is very important. When they were talking about the non-English speaking students, I just thought, that's my child right there. You know, also, there are people that are born and raised in this country that have as much difficulty as non-English speaking students. Sometimes maybe even a little bit more. So, I know this has been a long morning. So I would just like to say thank you very much for letting us testify. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Again, we appreciate your patience, and I'm really glad I got to hear your testimony.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2020, and we'll adjourn the subcommittee. Thank you, everyone.